Can you hear me? Hi, everybody. I'm Jillian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 13th of 1998, and I am extremely grateful for that. I'm a member of the Unity Group from Memphis, Tennessee. It's the best group in the world. And and I have lots of women here to support me, which is a miracle in itself, because I didn't have that before. So thank you all for coming. I have my sponsor here, and I have two of my sponsees, and that's such a gift. I have been nervous, so I'm losing my voice, but I think it will get louder as the nerves go away. So I've been told I talk too much at times, so the biggest thing on my mind right now, and while Arlene was reading, was be still and know that I am God. And I was just asking God to give me courage and strength to do this talk tonight. It's such a privilege to be asked. I can't believe I'm here. I just can't believe it. And the be still and know that I am God, I've just come off, probably the last month or two has been so hectic. And I haven't had, I always do my morning meditation and I thank God at night and I talk to him throughout the day, but I just haven't had a lot of just downtime, quiet time. And it's like I got up here and last night got in that meeting and it's like everything, the peace came over me. And when I went to bed last night, I do what I always do. I do my 10th step, which says on page 86, when we retire at night, I went through my day, and then I read my nightlight. I still do the same things today as I did 7.5 years ago. And then I read this other little book by Emmett Fox. And last night, you know, I was really nervous about today, even though I know that, you know, you ask God for the strength for the day, and yesterday was yesterday, and that's why I was nervous. But anyway, I picked up the book and it said the most important prayer of all is be still and know that I am God. And then this morning when I had my quiet time, the same thing happened. I was doing my morning prayers and I was doing my meditation and I looked at, I was going through the big book because I, you know, this is where it's all at for me today. And I had a little marker in there from the last time I spoke, which was at Earl's birthday, and I meant to finish off my talk, but I kind of talked long, and it was 9 o'clock, and I didn't get to read what I wanted to read. And I'm going to read it at the end today, even if I go over, I'm going to read it. But right at the end of that, I looked at it, and I had totally forgotten, but it said, be still and know that I am God. And that's just what I needed today, because as I said, I've been so rushed and everything, and I just needed to know, to be able to sit and to know that God's in charge tonight. So I am so grateful to be here. I got the call in January, and I can't believe it's November already, because I thought, well, I don't have to worry about that today. That's in November. And here we are. And this is always, you know, why I'm so grateful, one of the reasons I'm so grateful this time around is that I had old-timers in my life, and I lost both of them. Last year I lost Mary. Mary was my grand sponsor, and Mary had spoken here at Mont Eagle, and she talked about Mont Eagle, and it was always like this, you know, this very spiritual retreat that only certain people are invited to, and I just thought, oh my God, you know, I'll probably never go there, and you know, and then Louise was my great grand sponsor, and Louise passed away in January. And from what I understand now is that Louise spoke here, Mary spoke here, my sponsor Sherry spoke here, and now I'm speaking here, and talk about this ripple effect. And now I've got two sponsees sitting here tonight, and I hope that one day they get to speak here too, because it is such an honor. And all the new people, Jessica, I'm so glad you're here. I hope you hear something tonight. I always pray that I might help one person in the room. And what a journey you're on, Jessica. You just don't even know. You just got to hold on with both hands and just stay with these women. And that's what I did this time. I just hung on to these women, and at 6 months sober this time, I went on my first little trip like you're doing on this trip. And I haven't let go yet. You know, and in February, God willing, if I keep on doing what I do each day, it's a day at a time program, I'll have 8 years, and that's unbelievable for me, that I have 8 years, I have the same sponsor, and I do the same things that I did 8 years ago. I am so afraid of not doing, I'm pretty anal, so I have to do the same thing. Some people might call me rigid, but I take this program so seriously. I've been around since 1982, and yes, I knew Arlene, and it makes me cry when I look at Arlene, because if it wasn't for Arlene, I wouldn't be here. When I was so desperate 7 years ago, I saw Arlene in a meeting, and I knew that Arlene had changed. She wasn't the woman that I used to know. And I looked at Arlene, and you know, she was looking at the book, and when she shared, she was talking about the big book, and she was talking about this sponsor, and I just nudged and I was there because I was in desperation at that point, and I nudged the woman next to me, and I said, God, I'd never have a Nazi sponsor like that. And a week later, guess what? I asked her sponsor to be my sponsor, and I didn't even know that was the same woman, but it was. So you need to be careful what you say and what you pray for, and you know, God had other plans for me, and thank God I did find the sponsor I have, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her either. But Arlene actually came to pick me up in the Grace House in 1983 to take me to a meeting. So I've been around since, actually came in 1982 in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I talk about the old timers, Mary and Louise, Mary and Louise and Sherry taught me how to respect and love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous today. I love it with every fiber of my being. And, you know, I have so much gratitude for this program, because if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't be here today. When you get to hear my story, I was a pretty desperate person. I had many, many suicide attempts. I didn't want to live. And I lived the type of life that was unbelievable. And I did things that I never would have done in my right mind. I'm feeling really emotional tonight. But anyway, I'm grateful for these women. They've saved my life. And so, I think I introduced myself well, didn't I? I said where I was from. Okay, I said my home group, and I love my home group today. And when I first came into AA, I had a home group, but after a period of time, I didn't have a home group anymore, and I was never active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous did change my life. I wasn't doing the things that I used to do. But I didn't give back. I was a taker in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't a giver in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God that has changed today. The more I do, the happier I am, and to get out of self. But I'm gonna go back and tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I was born in London, England, and I came to America when I was 20 years old. And my childhood, I had a mother and father. They were a lot older when they had me. They were both 40 and 41, I guess, when they had me. And I always, you know, I guess I felt real different because I had older parents, and I was pretty ashamed of my parents, which really I had nothing to be ashamed of. I had very good parents. They were not alcoholics. We had alcohol in the house that came out on special occasions. It was under lock and key. And there was no drinking in the house. My father was probably obsessive compulsive, and I was just ashamed of my parents. But when I look back, that was a lot of my perception. This is definitely a disease of perception. The way I saw things really weren't the way it was. Growing up, I would say one of the in the big book, it talks about a guy named Jim who had a nervous disposition. That was me. I was Jim. And I had a lot of anxiety. I had lots of fears. And I just kind of lived that way. And yet, on the outside, hey, Margaret. Melissa, that's great. On the outside, you would never have known that I had any of these problems, because I really didn't let anybody know how I was. I had a sister that was 11 years older than I am, and I did a lot of things that, you know, maybe, I don't know if this is normal or not, but I did a lot of things to get a lot of attention. And, you know, like my sister started bringing boyfriends home, and I'd lock myself in the bathroom, you know, to get, you know, anything to get attention away from my sister. And, you know, that's kind of the way I was. And in school, you know, I probably was ADD and wasn't, you know, in those days, nothing was diagnosed. And I had a lot of trouble in school. I was bright, but yet, you know, I had a lot of fear over exams, and I always just barely got through. But I think today probably more would have been recognized about that. And my sister went to Africa when I was 9 years old. So after that, I was really like an only child. She married a South African, and she lived there till I came. She went from Africa to America, and she moved to America. And then when I was 20 years old, I came to America and lived with my sister. So I really didn't know her very well, and she did come home probably to visit a couple of times, but it was really, you know, I've never really had that closeness with my sister. When I was about 11 or 12, 13, that's when the boys started coming into the picture. And, you know, they talk about, you know, alcoholics being very, you know, whatever my parents would tell me, I would do the opposite. And my relationships from very early on were very up and down, rocky. My emotions were up and down all the time. And I had this one boyfriend all of my teenage life, and my parents were very much against it. And the more that they were against it, the more I was for it. And, you know, eventually they left me alone. I got engaged to the guy. And then as soon as I was engaged to him, I didn't want him anymore. And that's kind of was the whole the way that I was my whole life. I would go after things. It was more the game of getting what I wanted, and as soon as I got it, I didn't want it anymore. And I guess that was that soul sickness inside. I was never satisfied with anything. You know, the grass was always greener on the other side. And so anyway, I did a lot of selfish things during those years. The guy that I was engaged to was a pharmacy student, and right before his final exams, it's like I met somebody else, and I just broke up with him. I didn't care. And this is definitely a disease of selfishness and self-centeredness, and I had it. And I had a love-hate relationship with my mother. My father, as I said, I was kind of ashamed of. The amazing thing today is I can look back and I can see how loving my parents really were. I had very loving parents. My father was very protective of me. He loved me dearly. My mother was very concerned about me, but I, you know, it's just these feelings that we had, and the feeling was that I wasn't wanted. They wanted a boy. His name was supposed to be Julian, and that's how I got the funny name Jillian. And they always wanted a boy. My father wanted a boy to take to football games, and I just thought I wasn't wanted, you know. And none of that was true. I checked that out later on, and they loved me more than anything. They had me right after the war. I was born in 1945, and they really wanted a child. They waited 11 years to have another child, and they wanted a child really badly. But I just really felt my whole life that I wasn't wanted. And when this engagement broke up, one of the things that also happened, I need to just tell you this real quickly, but when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I had a very bad burn, and I was put in the hospital. I pulled a tablecloth down with boiling water, and I poured it all over me, and I ended up in the emergency room, and I ended up in the hospital in an isolation ward. And I came home from the hospital from that experience, and then I got scarlet fever, which in those days you could have died from because they didn't have the antibiotics and everything. But anyway, they took me right back to the hospital, and I was in isolation again for 2 weeks. And I don't know, you know, if some of my problems started from that, but my mother and father were not allowed to come into the hospital to see me. And all I can imagine is that I probably thought that, you know, that I had died and my parents had left me. And from what came from that was terrible abandonment issues whenever, throughout my life, whenever anybody would leave me, or if I had to go somewhere or away from home, I had, you know, tremendous, tremendous fear. And it probably started right then. My mother told me later on that she would walk around the hospital and try to look in the window, and she was just mortified that she couldn't come in and see me. But I think for a little child, they probably thought that I'd been left and, you know, would never see my parents again. So anyway, I'm going to jump back now. And then when I was 20, what happened was I had this broken engagement, and you know, my relationships were always so emotional, and I absolutely fell apart. All my relationships, what I did was I took hostage of whoever I was with, made the man my god, and from that, because of that, I didn't really have any other friends. He was it. That guy was it. And even though I was the one that broke off the engagement, the guy that I went with, that wasn't the one that I wanted either. And I absolutely probably almost had a nervous breakdown. Still no alcohol in the picture here. And sometimes I think if I had drank, maybe things would have been better. I didn't know to drink then. I did have a problem with food. I was bulimic, and I had no idea that it had a name. I didn't talk about it. Nobody knew about it. And that was how I dealt with my feelings at that time. Alcohol, I'd had many, you know, probably a few times, maybe at weddings. I'm Jewish, maybe at a bar mitzvah or a wedding or something like that. Special occasions at home, and I always thought there was something special about it. I liked the smell, I liked the taste of sweet drinks, but I wasn't drinking at that time. I came to America to stay with my sister. My parents didn't know what to do with me, and they said, maybe if you go to America, first geographic here, everything will be okay. And I thought, well, maybe that's the answer. So I came out to America. I was 20 years old. Very inept at life, didn't know anything about life. And that's what I love about this program, is today I have a design for living that's in this book that showed me how to live life one day at a time. God, I wish I'd had it back then. I look at the young people today, and I was 39 when I first came into this program, and I was 50, what am I now, 50? I was 53 when I got this program this time. And oh my God, if I'd had it back then. So I just hope you just grab on. But I didn't have it then, and I know that's, you know, that wasn't my journey. But anyway, I came to America, and I guess I thought my sister and everybody was gonna save me, and you know, everything was gonna be okay, but it wasn't. And you know, it was a big culture shock coming from London, England. I worked in the heart of London, went from the age of 16 on. I didn't go to college. I went to secretarial school because I failed out of my last year of school because probably I couldn't concentrate because of the boyfriend. And you know, I think that was always kind of a low self-esteem thing for me too, also, that I didn't really finish school, even though I did go to secretarial school and get a job as a secretary and worked in a travel agency, and that's how I first got to come to America. But anyway, living with my sister and brother-in-law, I felt like I had moved into a home where I didn't know anybody, and I was the loneliness. They talk about the loneliness that alcoholics have, and I had that extreme loneliness. And I was dating a little bit at that time, and it was amazing that most of the guys that I met had an alcohol problem. So I did start drinking a little bit. And you know, in Bill's story, when it talks about when he went over there, when he went to Winchester Cathedral, I always kind of relate to him, because it's like Bill went over there and he had that extreme loneliness. I came from the other side of the ocean, and I had that extreme loneliness when I came to America. And of course, I couldn't tell anybody, I couldn't talk to my sister, and I you know, I would write letters home that everything was wonderful, and it really wasn't. And I moved out to California, and there the loneliness got deeper. And of course, I was doing a lot of, you know, crazy things with the food, and I'd also started at this time taking some prescription medication. And I was not drinking even then, but I came back from California, and I was looking for a man. I thought, gosh, I need to get married. If I get married, then everything's going to be okay. And I was on a mission to find somebody, and sure enough, I met somebody, and we got engaged in 6 weeks, and we got married in 6 months, and this man liked to drink. He liked to drink. And so I liked to drink along with him, and that's kind of how I started. And, you know, I used to tell my story, I used to blame him for my alcoholism, and I don't do that today because nobody pushed that drink down my throat. And he would come home from work, and he was a happy drunk, and the more he drank, the more amorous he got, and I couldn't stand it, so I'd start drinking before he got home and be kind of in the same condition of when he came home. So, So anyway, we had a very, very stormy relationship. I remember that first year of marriage. I remember standing, getting married to him, thinking, what the heck am I doing? And I didn't tell anybody that, but you know, I just thought that this is what I needed to make me happy. I was always trying to fill up that hole in my soul. I always had that hole inside of me, and I wanted something to make it better. And if it was the alcohol, it was, you know, whatever it was, the relationships, whatever, I always thought that was going to be it, and it wasn't it. So anyway, from there, I thought the next step was to have children. I thought if I had children, that's what I needed. I wanted, I can see today how all my things that I was doing was to just try to make me okay. It wasn't about the joy of having children or any of that, but I thought if I have kids, then I'll be okay. And I had my first child, and I can't remember if I drank when I was drinking or not, when I was, if I drank when I was pregnant or not. I just don't have, there's a lot of things that I don't really remember. But what I do remember is I had that child, and then 2 years later I had another child. But one of the things that happened for me was that I also was really drinking heavily in between these, the children. And I remember being pregnant with my second child, and I already had a man lined up on the side that as soon as I had that child, I was going to get together with this man. And I had a lot of affairs during my marriage. And everything I did through all the affairs I had, all the behaviors that I did, I always had to drink to do the things that I did. And, you know, when I look back at some of these things that I did, I mean, I just can't believe it. The man that I had lined up was my best friend's husband. I have a lot of things that I am so ashamed that I did, but I did it with alcohol. I had no conscience if I drank. And a lot of these people, there's this woman that had an affair with her husband, I would still like to make amends to today, but of course we don't do things that might hurt somebody else, so I would leave that in God's hands if she ever comes in my path, but so far she hasn't. But I'm willing to do whatever it takes today to stay sober. But anyway, this went on. I was married to this man for 12 years, and there was a lot of drinking, there was a lot of partying. We had a boat, we went out, there was a lot of drinking on the boat. My children have told me later on that they, you know, there were times that I threatened to jump off that boat. You know, there's a lot of things that I don't even remember, but the children they lived that kind of life with us. I'm not saying that I was a bad mother all the time, but I sure wasn't really thinking. Their interest was not upmost in my mind. It was about drinking and partying, and then it got to the point where I really didn't want to be married anymore, and I didn't have the guts to leave that husband. And so there were times that I just went off and left. I'd meet a man, I'd tell my husband I was leaving him, I left him with the children. And as soon as I got away with this other person, whoever it was, you know, 5 or 6 weeks later, I didn't want him anymore. And I came back with my tail behind, you know, between my legs and said, would you take me back again? And he took me right back again. We were real sick. And we never got any help. We didn't get any outside help at that time. And we just thought that, you know, we'll redecorate the house or we'll do something like this and everything will be okay. And it was okay for about 6 months or 7 months. And then again, I'd be out looking for the next victim that I was, you know, going to run off with. And my children lived this way, and during this period of time, my in-laws had to come in and take care of my responsibilities that I should have been doing. But I wanted a party, and I wanted a rock and roll, and I just didn't want that responsibility, and I didn't have the guts to ask for a divorce. And so I wanted my cake and eat it at the same time, and I kept coming back, and the time that my in-laws came to look after my children one time, my father-in-law had a heart attack and passed and died while he was at my house, and I was off living with some other man at that time. And, you know, these are some of the things that happened. And this is not all of it, because it got a whole lot worse. It got a whole lot worse. I finally got to the point where one night, my husband was probably alcoholic too, and we were separated at the time, and I was out there doing my thing, and he came over to my house one night, and I got beaten up pretty badly in front of my children. My husband was in a blackout, I know that today, but at the time I didn't know that, and it got to that level in my marriage before I had the guts to leave that marriage. And I don't blame my husband today for anything, because I put that man through hell. But from that, what happened after that was my drinking, and then of course there were other things that happened. I started getting to other substances too. There was always alcohol, but I had other things that really escalated my alcoholism. And I was getting to the point where there were suicide attempts, and I ended up in St. Francis Hospital on the crazy ward. And, you know, I don't know at that time if anybody told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea that I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't remember anybody saying that, you know, Jillian, you have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And I had people bring stuff into me, and I just, you know, I don't remember anything about it, and I would just come out and do the same thing all over again. And eventually what happened was I got to the point where there was, I had a suicide attempt, and I was about to lose my job. We become unemployable, and that's what happened for me. And I knew that the handwriting was on the wall, and I knew that I had to get away. And what happened was eventually I got a job offer in California. And one day I was high as a kite, and I went downtown, and I signed the papers, and I just signed those children over to my husband. And I just gave up my two children that were 9 and 11 years old. And it was almost like it was a big relief, because I absolutely couldn't take care of those children anymore. And I knew that I had to get away, and I moved out to California, and I left my two children. It was total insanity. My two children today are 36 and 38 years old, and one of them is doing beautifully, and the other one is 36 years old, living in New York. He came into Alcoholics Anonymous 15 years ago, and he still struggles. I'm going to get more into the story about what happened to me being in this program in untreated alcoholism, and my son is living the same kind of life in California today. In New York today. He thinks he's in the program, but he is a loner. He's isolated. He has no contact with his family. And, you know, he's in my prayers every day, but I did a lot of damage to my children. My youngest son, who's 36, is very successful. He's an attorney. I have two beautiful grandchildren today. And on the outside, it doesn't look like he's suffered. He lived in the same house with my son, my other son, and yet one child has done so well and one hasn't. So I don't know what that's about, but he is wound very tight. And just, you know, God forbid anything ever happens in his family, you know, maybe he'll say there was, you know, need some help. But right now he looks like he's doing good. But the damage that's done in families through alcoholism, there's been a lot of damage. Anyway, so here I go. I went out to California. And I'll tell you what, when I got to California, it's like those two children, I didn't want responsibility of my children. I wanted to rock and roll. I wanted, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to, you know, drink and do the other stuff that I was doing. And those children were getting in my way. And more than anything, I wanted a guy. I wanted a guy really bad to again rescue me and take care of me. And I really believed that my children were getting in the way of me finding another relationship. And so I just ran off. And those children were left in that house with my ex-husband. He just moved into my house. He moved into my house, and you know, I rationalized in my mind, if he moved into my house, it was going to be just like I, you know, that it wouldn't, nothing would matter. You know, I'd leave the furniture. I thought I was being very kind. I'd leave all the furniture, leave everything there, and they'd be just fine. And of course, that wasn't the case. And those children, you know, he brought in a lot of women in the house. I heard there was no food in the house. You know, there was alcohol in the refrigerator, and that was about it. And those kids for the next 2 years, I guess they were in God's care because they survived, but it was a horrible existence for them. And I don't blame him, because I was the one that left. And then my oldest son, there were some things that happened with my oldest son and my youngest son. There was a lot of some abuse that went on, and I wasn't there to protect that child. And, you know, I know today that I know that I have been forgiven by God. I've forgiven myself, because I was a very, very sick person. I think it was a blessing that I didn't take those children with me, because I think that if I had, they probably would have been taken away by, they would have been taken away from me by the way that I lived in California. So I am grateful that I didn't take those children with me and drag them through the things that I had to go through for the next 2 years while I was in LA. The job that I went out for, of course, I couldn't keep. by this time, I was drinking, you know, all day long. I was doing other things. And when I worked in Memphis, I had a job working in a nightclub selling memberships on my own time. I could just go out and do it whenever I wanted, so I was able to keep it for a long time. When I went out to LA, I had a 9-to-5 job, and of course I could not keep that job. I think I was fired within the first 2 or 3 weeks. I had to have my bottle with me. I had to go into the, you know, to the ladies' room and drink. And I couldn't wait to get off and drink again, and finally I got fired. And for the next couple of years, I was in and out of jobs. It wasn't the next couple of years, it was the next couple of months, because I couldn't keep a job. I became unemployable. I had many suicide attempts. I had to find a man to take care of me, a man that I hated. I was very promiscuous. I mean, I would do whatever it take to get what I needed. I became the kind of person that I never thought ever that would happen to me. There is one part in the book that I just wanted to read, because this is what happened here. It says, how dark it is before the dawn. And this is what happened. The next 2 years was the darkness that happened before the dawn started to show up. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And God, I didn't know that at that time. I had to do another 2 years of this yet. I had to do another 2 years of reaching that bottom. And the times that I would call my children and say, I'm coming home, Mommy's coming home to you. And one time the man that was supporting me, you know, he brought those children out to LA to see me, and they were so excited to see me. And I remember taking them around to, you know, to places they shouldn't see. I remember baking brownies with funny stuff in them, and those kids were there stirring the bowl, and they saw the type of people that I was living with and spending my time with. And I wasn't working at this point, and I was just, you know, sitting and doing the things that I was doing 24 hours a day with chemicals in my body, and I was becoming paranoid and just full of fear, and I could not stop. And I still did not know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And one little thing that happened that was the start of, God was there. He was there many times during this journey that I was on. And I remember one time going to Florida and ruining my parents had come out from England, and they'd come to Florida, and I got off the plane totally drunk. I'd been drinking champagne on the plane and embarrassed my family. And every time I would go out for lunch with my parents, my mother one time looked at me and she said, are you one of those alcoholics? And I said, you know, are you crazy? You know, anybody that would ever say that maybe you had a problem, I just said, forget it. And, you know, I remember her saying that, and then I remember when I came to L.A., the first time I drove into L.A. in my little beat-up, you know, alcoholic car. It's supposed to take 3 days to get from Memphis to L.A. It took me about 6 days. I got sidetracked in Las Vegas and, picked up some man that had stalked me for the next 2 years. These are the dangerous situations women put themselves in, the dangerous situations. And anyway, I drove into LA in this beaten up car, and I drove into a gas station, and this man looked at me, and he identified himself as a member of this program. And he didn't know me from Adam, he didn't know who I was, and he said, he asked me my name, and he said, Jillian, I think you have a problem. And he told me that he had got help in Chicago many years ago, and that if I ever needed help, that he would be there. And I just laughed in his face. Well, for the next 2 years in L.A., you know, I was out and about and doing my thing, and many occasions I would bump into this man in the most surprising places, and he would always look at me and he'd just say, you know, Jillian, I think you're one of us, I think you have a problem. And I said, you know, you're crazy, I don't have any problem. You know, suicide attempts, you know, all the men every night and doing the things I was doing and couldn't keep jobs and, you know, the lies to my family and my children, but I didn't think I had a problem. And what happened eventually for me was I actually did get a job finally again. And the only way I got it was a sales job, and I could kind of work on my own time. And I eventually got fired in this job because I was doing things I shouldn't do. And of course, the visits to the doctors and the therapists and the lies we tell everybody And I was, you know, and the, you know, the pills for my nerves and all the things, and, you know, I was just falling apart all over the place. And what happened one night was, I used to make these crazy phone calls at night and be up all night with the stuff that I was doing that we probably all know about. And one night, and this was like in 1982, and in those days the TV used to go off at night about 2 or 3 in the morning, and there was a religious message on the television. And I don't know what hit me, but something hit me. I don't remember what the message said, but the next day I called a hotline for help. Didn't call Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I called a hotline for help. And one thing that did happen, there was, I lived in an apartment building, and there was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at that building, and we used to sit by the pool drinking and smoking our stuff, and we'd laugh at those poor people that were going up to that meeting, whatever it was. I thought people were going up there drinking in that meeting. I didn't know, that was the only thing I ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I called the hotline for help, and see, I had got fired from that job 28 days before, and if I had called any 2 days later, I don't know if it was the 28th or the 29th day, but if I had called 1 day later, my insurance wouldn't have been there. But for some reason, that night, that was a God deal, I called that number, it was a hotline, and they came and picked me up and took me to an alcoholics, they took me to an alcohol and drug treatment center that cost $12,000 in those days, which I never would have been able to get into. And I thought my life was over. Oh my God. I didn't have anything. I didn't have work. I had this man paying for my rent. Didn't have a penny to my name, but I had this attitude like, oh my God, how did I end up in this treatment center? And, you know, I arrived with all my clothes and all my suitcases and, you know, I mean, I was not there for the right reasons, but I was dying and I was at that jumping off point. And for the next 6 months, well, what happened in that treatment center was they told me that I had to go to a halfway house. They knew that if I went back to the life that I had before, that I would go back and do what I had always done. And what happened, what I didn't tell you was when I first got to that treatment center, I'm walking down the hall with all my suitcases. Just on the outside, I was still looking good. I exercised with all these drugs in me and all this alcohol in me. So on the outside, I still looked pretty good because that's the way I got rid of my hangovers, by exercising. So, you know, people would say, well, you don't really have a problem, but I really, you know, I had the problem, but I didn't look like it. So I'm walking down there and I see this man, I see the back of him walking down the hall, and he turned around and it was the man from the gas station. And what happened was this man had sold his gas station and now he was the director of this treatment center. And I get little goosebumps when I say that, but you think that was the end, that was the start of, it was the start of my journey, but my bread wasn't done yet, so. But he was just grateful that in 1982 I had finally arrived in the start of this journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened from there was that he told me that, they told me there that I had to go to a halfway house. I can't believe it's time 5 to 9. Can I go over, please? All right. So they told me that I had to go to a halfway house. And, you know, for the next 6 months, I was in and out of 10 different halfway houses. I almost ended up in a state hospital. I was at the jumping off point where I knew that I couldn't go back to that old life, but oh my God, I can't go to this new life either. I couldn't stand the way I felt. I had so much anxiety, I had so much depression, I had so much fear, I had panic attacks, and I had a woman very early on try to help me and say, Jillian, please don't give up before the miracle happens. And every time I kept giving up before the miracle happens, I could not imagine life with alcohol, and I couldn't imagine life without alcohol, and I always made that ultimate sacrifice and left those treatment centers and picked up that drink and drug. And I ended up, and every day I would, and the next day I would check myself right back in again, because I knew I couldn't go back to that life. What happened for me was they told me to get a strong foundation in sobriety. I finally ended up in one place that I stayed for a few months. It was called the Friendly House in Los Angeles, and I wasn't honest in that place, but for some reason they let me stay, and they told me to get a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had so much guilt from leaving those children. All those feelings were coming up for me. I couldn't stand it, and I knew I had to get back. And they said, get a foundation. Don't do this till you're ready. But I didn't listen to anybody. I wasn't very teachable. And I got back in that little old alcoholic car and I drove back to Memphis. And I believe that was the journey that I was supposed to do, because there was a song about Welcome to Memphis, that Memphis song. And as I was driving over that Arkansas bridge, they played that song. And I thought, I am supposed to come back here. But what happened was, I still couldn't. I thought I had to have some big old fancy job, and I wasn't grateful. And my eating disorder kicked back in, and I did go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did find a sponsor, but it wasn't the kind of sponsorship that I have today. God, I have strong sponsorship today. I have sponsorship, and I had grand sponsorship and great-grand sponsorship from Louise and Mary, who I just followed around like a little puppy dog. And thank God it saved my life. And Jessica and Shana, is that right? That's what I had to do this time. I didn't do this the first time around. I wish that I had, but I still, you know, I was at the age I was. I've never done what somebody else told me to do, and this time, thank God, I did that. But I didn't do that then. And after 14 months, I did go to meetings, but I wasn't sponsored from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what I was sponsored from, but I did go to, you know, I guess I went to my meetings, and, you know, I just hung out at meetings. I thought it was all about me, and it was what I was supposed to get, not what I was supposed to give. And I ended up going to the dentist. I believe in total abstinence today, and I got some pain pills, and I was off and running. And I went to a meeting, and they told me they saw death in my eyes, and I ended up at Lakeside Hospital in Memphis. And from there, I had no insurance. They sent me to the Grace House. I lived in Grace House for 6 months. Again, I was not honest. Oh my God, rigorous honesty, rigorous honesty. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And it talks about honesty, honesty, honesty in that first paragraph and how it works. And I couldn't get rigorously honest because I still had that front up, and I was so afraid of letting all of you know who I am. And I did some things in the Grace House that, you know, it wasn't about getting sober. You know, I mean, I guess I went through the motions, but I was, you know, I started smoking. You know, I had an attitude, you know, I wanted special treatment. And I just wasn't grateful. I wasn't grateful for my sobriety, but I absolutely thought I'd never drink again. And I came out of the Grace House, and I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 years after that. And I have to tell you that my life got a whole lot better after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't doing the crazy things I was doing before. I was able to get jobs. But the thing was that I did very well in my life when I was by myself. As soon as I got into job situations, I got into relationship situations, I got into family situations, I still had problems. I had a lot of problems because I had stopped working the steps. I had stopped doing the things that I know that I have to do today. I have to do it on a daily basis. I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I got into a lot of other things. I got into a lot of religions. I went through about 4 or 5 different religions. I got into a lot of meditation stuff, and all of this stuff in of itself is very good stuff, but Alcoholics Anonymous got further and further away. I went to meetings. I no longer had a home group. I wasn't sponsoring. I had stopped working the steps. I had the same sponsor for 13 years. It was a friendship club with her. She kind of sponsored me, and I kind of sponsored her. She listened to all my problems. She took me in when I had bad relationships and had to get away from the guys. And, you know, it was all that type of thing, but I have a sponsor today that will listen to my problems for about 2 minutes, and then, God, we get into the solution, and she backs it up with everything that's in this book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The transformation had not taken place, and I love in the 12 and 12 where it says that we've been transformed, we have been transformed, but we have to work this program, and I had to work this program, and I didn't do that before. And with God's grace, you know, my life got better in those 14 years, but I had a lot of problems in lots of different areas, and I isolated from my family for 2 years at one time, accusing them of things that they didn't do. I went into therapy and got all kinds of crazy ideas put in my head, and, you know, I was still selfish. I didn't think about how I was hurting other people. But anyway, what happened for me eventually was, and along the line there, you know, I did drink about year 7. I got into some religious things where I picked up alcohol. I got back into the I've been Buddhism and Christianity and everything else in between, and I got back into Judaism. And you could drink wine on Friday night when you light the candles. And boy, I thought, well, for religious reasons, I can do that. And, you know, the insanity, and I didn't tell people, and I started drinking non-alcoholic beer and non-alcoholic wine, and I am very grateful with God's grace that I didn't go back to the life that I used to have, because, God, I was headed that way. But what happened for me was I met this man that I was about to that I was engaged to, and we had this terrible relationship, but the man, this is my husband today, he did stay with me. And I was at the point where I was about to get married. I had everything to live for. You know, my life could have got a whole lot better, but I wanted to die. And I was desperate. I was at that desperation point. And I thought it was from something else. You know, I thought it was, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. I was going to all these therapists. And, you know, I had no idea that all these years around this program, I was in untreated alcoholism. And that's what happened for me, was I reached my bottom I guess I met Sherry in January of 1998, and oh my God, that's when my journey started. I don't know what was different this time, but I knew that I was either going to get locked up or I was going to die. I knew that something had to change, and I guess I had that one little bit of willingness to say, you know, whatever it takes now, I'm willing to do. And it talks about the desperation, as being as desperate as a dying can be. And I just didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for me. I just didn't realize, you know, I guess I thought Alcoholics Anonymous had changed. The only person that had changed was me. But there was something that, from a series of events, when the student's ready, the teacher appears, and my friend Gina showed up in my life around December. And then, of course, I told you I saw Arlene. And that led me to a meeting at the Tower in Memphis, and that was where, you know, at the time I said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I burst out crying. I went to lunch with Gina and with Sherry, and I asked Sherry if she would sponsor me. And what I can tell you about my sponsor, Sherry, was I didn't know who she was. I didn't know anything about her. I didn't know her last name. I knew that she had something. When it showed in Bill's story, when it talks about Abby coming to call on Bill, and there was something in his eyes, there was something in her eyes. She was on fire. She wasn't just in, I mean, she was on fire with this program. And I knew that she had something, and I knew I had nothing. And I just, you know, had to humble myself and say, Sherry, would you please sponsor me? And from there, she gave me very clear-cut directions what to do. And for the first time in my life, you know, in my 53 years old, I was ready just to be a puppet and do exactly what this woman told me to do. And I didn't even know that I wanted to. I didn't know if it would work. I didn't know if I believed in it. I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous could be any different than my experience before. But I just followed what she told me one day at a time. And I know today that I cannot rest on my laurels. I have to do this daily. And she gave me a little simple direction. She took me right to the book where she said, "There, Jillian, page 25 in the big book, there is no middle of the road solution. There is no middle of the road. You're either going to do this time and thoroughly follow our path, or you're going to go back and do what you did before." And thank God, I had that willingness to do what she said to do. And after a while, I did it because I loved it. I mean, it was amazing. And I absolutely arranged my whole life around meeting with her every week to get through those steps. And it's been a wonderful journey ever since. I mean, I just can't tell you what this program has done for me. Thank God I had Mary in my life. It was such a loss to lose Mary, my grand sponsor. I was very close to her. She taught me so much. And she taught me the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and how much I love that today. And knowing what an amazing gift, it's such a gift that every one of us has been given to have another chance at life. I know that I'm living on borrowed time. I know I made a big deal out of doing this tonight, but my sponsor told me right away that there are no big deals. The only big deals is bad health. If you have bad health, that's a big deal. But all the other stuff, the fear and the anxiety and all the stuff I have over things like this, really there's no big deals. And God is in charge, and my relationship with God today is awesome. More and more, I want to have more faith and trust in God. I still have fear at times. I don't like it that I still have that, but God, it makes me pray more. And what I do every day is I do my third step prayer, I do my seventh step prayer, I do the 11th step prayer, I do the serenity prayer. These are my prayers that I use on a daily basis, and my life has got greater and greater. And I thank you so much for inviting me. It's been such an honor and a privilege. And just hang in there, girls. This is the journey of a lifetime. And the biggest gift of all is giving it away to other people. To know that we have a that I have a purpose, somebody that had the life that I had, that this is the greatest thing that I can do, that God kept me alive, maybe to help one other person to live today. And for somebody like me that was the lowest of the low, that didn't believe in myself in any way, that didn't think that I could help another person with anything, to be able to use this gift of my life to help somebody else to live today, that is such an awesome gift. And I get to do it in my work too. I have my own business today. That's an awesome deal too. I get to help a lot of people with the principles of this program and the steps of this program. So thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.